Hey, you're listening to the Words on Flicks show with me, Janine Coveney.
You're listening to the Words on Flicks show on eWater Radio. KEWR-DB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of eWater Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of eWater Radio, KEWR-DB, or its affiliates.
Welcome to the Words on Flicks show for October 2023. I'm your host, entertainment journalist, and film fan, Janine Coveney. This month, I'm talking about science fiction, and I have a treat for you. I was able to get a truly distinguished guest to talk about a fascinating and growing aspect of the sci-fi genre, which is Afrofuturism. I didn't really know that much about it, to be honest with you, although I have been exposed to some of these ideas. Now, this isn't a new concept by any means, but I had never really examined how Afrofuturism plays out in film, fiction, music, art, and other parts of the culture. So I'm really thrilled to welcome Yatasha L. Womack, and let me tell you more about her. She is a filmmaker and author, a dancer, independent scholar, and champion of humanity and the imagination. I love that. Her book, Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, came out in 2013, and it's the leading primer, however you say it, on the exciting subject, which bridges science fiction, futurism, and culture. Yatasha tours the world championing Afrofuturism and the role of the imagination. She is currently developing other Afrofuturist films, including Bar Star City and Rayla 2212, a time-traveling reincarnation book series, follows her character Rayla Illmatic. Her most recent project is the book Black Panther, A Cultural Exploration, which debuted on October 3rd. So she'll talk more about that. So sit back and settle in because we're going to be talking about the mind-blowing, mind-expanding, mind-liberating concept of people of color in space, time, and other dimensions via Afrofuturism. Come with me. Yatasha Womack, I am so happy to have you here. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted.
So can you talk a little bit about science fiction and how Afrofuturism fits?
Yes. Well, one, thank you for inviting me to be a part of this podcast. There's nothing more exciting than talking about Afrofuturism and science fiction. And, you know, the world of films in those realms have really shaped a lot of us. I wrote a book called Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. And I like to remind people that it's a way of looking at futures or alternate realities, but you're doing so through Black cultural lenses, you know, African diasporic cultural lenses. So whether you're in the U.S., or you're in Namibia, or you're in Brazil, or Jamaica, or France, the UK, we all have a relationship to space and time. Some are contemporary, some have older African origins, and this impacts our storytelling, a lot of the music that we create. And in more recent years, it was the term itself was created by Mark Derry when he wrote this essay called Black to the Future. It was really kind of an exploratory essay where he interviewed Greg Tate and Samuel Delaney, you know, and others really trying to look at Trisha Rose. And he was really just trying to give a name to this amalgamation of works that Black people, and he really focused on African Americans, had created. So looking at someone like a Sun Ra, Parliament Funkadelic, the Milestone Comics, and you had, you know, a lot of sci-fi references in hip-hop culture, in this sort of idea of a sense of alienness that Black people sometimes felt in their experience here in the Americas and how that played out and sort of question why there wasn't either more study or more focus around those concepts. So Alondra Nelson, some years later, after that term was developed, started a listserv in the early internet days. And a lot of people gathered on that site and were exploring these ideas. And the term exploded. And as the term became more popular, I think more people began to see themselves in that work. So whether you like comics, or you were really into science fiction films, or you were a person who liked, say, esoteric jazz, or you liked the sci-fi hip-hop references, or you just like thinking about Black people in the future and speculating and talking about those ideas, we were able to see that that is a body of knowledge, because all cultures have a relationship to space and time. And in our case, it comes through in our music, our poetics, dance, film, you know, architecture, design, hairstyling, you know, it can be a lived experience as well as a speculative one. But how is it different from science fiction? Well, one, because it centers African diasporic ways of thinking or lived experiences. And two, because it generally regards time as nonlinear, meaning that time's not just going in one direction. Time can go in a lot of different directions. And some of this is connected to some of our older African traditions around how we think about time and space, the liminality in space, you know, where the visible and not visible worlds are very much one. And then it's also different in the sense that it really values intuition as much as it does our logic, the logic sides of ourselves, right? It sees that as a valid space to pull from. So Afrofuturism, it's not just a genre, right? It's really, using more academic terms, you could say it's a way of thinking, an epistemology, a way of knowing, or an ontology. But, you know, for some, it's a healing practice, particularly for people who have issues with the imagination, who've been socialized not to really imagine and not to think about futures or to feel that that's not relevant. But it's also great, I think, because it's a way of sort of reclaiming or thinking about the relationships that Black people at different times and spaces have had to, well, time and space, but also to futures. And finding those connections. So that's how you could talk about a Janelle Monáe and her reimagining herself as a, you know, the arc android, or through the pleasure practices that she's celebrating. And then simultaneously, you could talk about the liberation efforts of someone like, you know, Martin Luther King, and looking to dreams and articulating that sort of vision. You know, you could also talk about, you could go from that realm of the arts, you can go from activism, you can talk about these philosophies, and you see, oh, wait, there's a relationship. So sometimes people will say things like, oh, man, Afrofuturism, it's so many things. Well, it's not so many things, but it's applied in a lot of different ways. And we're all at different points with respect to how we access it. And sometimes for people who aren't African diasporic people, there's an excitement about it, because as human beings, we're reclaiming all aspects of ourselves, taking all these lived experiences and these perspectives to really assess how we see the world, you know, and think about how do we want to build in the future. So in that sense, you know, Afrofuturism, it could be this, it's this theory, it's this aesthetic.
That is amazing, because I've only become familiar with the term, I would say, in the last few years. But honestly, as someone who came up in the 70s listening to all those Parliament Funkadelic records and all that cosmology and mythology around Africans, African Americans in space and living these alternate lives and lifestyles out in the galaxy, that was, you know, an early exposure to that kind of thinking. And also, it's important to ground us as human beings in a future that is imagined on film. So thank you for explaining that. And I know that you can have a film of multiple genres melding fantasy and sci-fi. And I think in a way that's where maybe Black Panther exists. So can you talk a little bit about Black Panther and the new book that just came out?
Yes. Well, the film Black Panther was a juggernaut in the film space, and for a lot of people who became fans once the film was released. The Black Panther character was created in 1966 and debuted in a Fantastic Four comic. And I had the pleasure of writing a book called Black Panther, A Cultural Exploration, that really focuses on the narratives and relationships to the comic over the years, to the character, all of which led to the excitement about the character in recent years and the support around it and just the demand for an expansion of the canon of science fiction, you know, just by fans around the world, lent itself to the rise of this character and the character being depicted in the film Black Panther, which is still, you know, one of the highest grossing films to debut.
And the character was not originally created by a person of color. Is that true?
Well, the character was created by the founders of Marvel. You know, they created the character and created the character generally because, you know, there was, you know, in the mid 60s, you have the Black Arts Movement, you have the rise of a different nature of kind of the liberation movement. And there was a desire at some point to have a Black character who symbolized those changes and transformation. Mm-hmm. So the arc of the character and the many writers who helped to shape it were in part influenced by histories and cultures and changing dynamics that were within the culture, whether they're pulling from ancient Egypt with Bast or they're pulling from these possible Black protopias or Black utopias, you know, in the idea of Wakanda, pulling from ancient civilizations and sort of these more modern takes on transforming the world in a kind of universalism.
Right.
So, you know, the film was a blockbuster, I think, in part, because for many people, it was their first time seeing not just a highly advanced African society, but a fantastic world with Black people that's African diasporic centered. And then you have this sort of larger narrative of a royal family and infighting, the metaphors that come out of it.
the hero's journey, you know, he starts out and then he falls and has everything taken from him. And he has to go through this internal and external journey to regain it. You know, it's a classic story. So, I mean, that first movie was just amazing to watch and to feel all of those African influences. I don't think anything had been done on screen like that before. All the detail of it was really astounding.
Oh, so yeah, certainly not on that scale. I mean, from the design, the costume design, the art design, all of which was Oscar winning, by the way. I think it's just a real testament to a lot of the creatives and the direction of people, one, creating a dynamic project, but then two, you know, just audiences just being astounded by the level of storytelling.
How many times did you see it, Yatasha?
Oh, gee, when it came out or since?
How many times did you see it in the theater?
Oh, I probably saw it in theater about 5 or 6 times.
Me too, I have to say. So that's awesome. So congratulations on the book. And I'm looking forward to reading the book, actually. And I have started reading your book, which is an essential book on Afrofuturism. But I invited you to talk a little bit about films that you feel are key or that you want to make mention of in terms of science fiction and why they're important, what you like about them. So I'll give you the first choice of film to talk about.
Yeah, and let me say this. I think a lot of my introduction to science fiction really came more or less through music and film.
Really?
Initially.
Music,
yes.
And film. Okay.
Yes. Right. So I'm thinking about the Parliament Funkadelic album covers and the Earth, Wind, and Fire album covers and you know, all of which you had the pyramids, space, but and other films as well, which we'll get to. But as an Afrofuturist, the first film that I have to say is a film called Space is the Place, which is a film that stars jazz icon Sun Ra. And is really almost a visual narrative to his classic album, Space is the Place.
The music is different here. The vibrations are different. Not like Planet Rave. Planet Rave's sound of guns, anger, frustration. There was no one to talk to from planet Earth, if you understand. We set up a colony of black people here. See what they can do on the planet all their own without any white people there. They could drink in the beauty of this planet. It would affect their vibrations for the better, of course. Another place in the universe, up under different stars. That would be where the altered destiny would come in.
The film itself came out in 1974. And, you know, if people didn't know who Sun Ra was and they didn't quite, you know, understand his music, this particular film was really almost a visual album and sort of a visual metaphor for what he was actually talking about. And so it was a bit of an art house film in one sense, but it was directed by John Coney. And it's a classic now. Maybe it was always a classic, an instant classic, but it's a classic now because it's one of the earlier films that we can identify as specifically Afrofuturist. In this film, Sun Ra, and just to give people a little bit of background, Sun Ra is a jazz artist who took on the mythology that he was really from Saturn. Mm-hmm. And that the sense of alienness he felt in segregated America came from the fact that he literally was an alien, but he was an alien brought here to heal the world with music. So he took these two concepts. He named himself after an Egyptian deity. And he's doing this in the 50s, right? So there's still this idea that Egypt isn't shaped by Black African people or melanated people. Mm-hmm. So he's naming himself after an Egyptian deity. And then he's also saying that he's from another planet. So he's taking these futures, these ancient histories, and this kind of future trajectory and merging it together. And he talked about something called the altered destiny. And so in the film, he literally comes to Earth and he's looking to bring people along the altered destiny. And one of the more key scenes that people like to talk about in this film, which is trippy. It's trippy in the sort of, in a bohemian Afrofuturist sort of way, but at some very real moments where Sun Ra, dressed in, you know, Egyptian space-inspired garb, goes into a community center and he's talking to a group of teenagers and he's telling them that they aren't real. They're a myth. And if they were actually real, they would have rights in this world, and they don't, and therefore they are a myth. But he talks about sort of actualizing this mythology. And a lot of the narrative is about him sort of encouraging people to go to the altered destiny. And if you ever listen to the album, which was re-released recently in vinyl form, and I actually wrote the liner notes for it, which I'm very excited about.
Congrats. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the album has a lot of elements in it that where he's using music, he's pushing the boundaries of jazz. He's bringing in African percussion. He's bringing in a lot of electronic elements into jazz. I mean, he was really one of the early forerunners in bringing electronics into jazz, but he's using it to create worlds with the music. So, you know, when you listen to his album and you're watching the film, I almost think of it as if you look at The Wizard of Oz. You know, The Wizard of Oz was, you know, there's some theories that The Wizard of Oz wasn't about Dorothy traveling at all. It was more of this sort of metaphysical narrative.
Okay.
And when they did it, the film version, you know, it really made it look like she went to a world and there were four people. You know, it took on a different articulation that she was going to a real place. But when you look at Sun Ra and the film Space is the Place, you know, there's this visceralness, you know, to the idea of traveling, you know, where, and the same thing is depicted in the album where you're wondering, is it just a human consciousness transformation that he's talking about? Or is he talking about literally going to another world, another plane, where the world is both destination and transport at the same time? But there's been a lot of elements from this film that have been duplicated in other movies. I mean, there is some of the musical elements in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where they're using music to sort of to communicate,
yes, to communicate
with the aliens. I'm telling you, there's a song on Space is the Place that seems to be it's using the same chords. Okay. I'm not saying it's the same song. I'm just saying a lot of similarities between the two. And maybe this whole idea of using music to communicate that was in that film was inspired by Sun Ra. And then there's also other scenes from Lovecraft Country. You know, there's one of the episodes where one of the characters, you know, she winds up in space and, you know, she's trying to, you know, claim who she is. People talk about the Afrofuturist episode. There's elements there that are directly pulled visually from the Space is the Place film. So
that is fascinating. I tried to watch that series, but it just got a little odd for me. I had trouble following it.
And Space is the Place, again, very much the art film, very avant-garde. So if you're looking for typical narrative, that's not necessarily what you're going to see in this film.
Got it. Well, thanks for that, because I was not as familiar with it. But in talking about a non-linear, perhaps, narrative, but one of my favorites is 2001, A Space Odyssey, that came out in 1968. It's directed by Stanley Kubrick.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
And it's considered, you know, a landmark film for its cinematography, its special effects, its use of music, but mostly for its ideas about the evolution of humanity from earliest beginnings on Earth to life for humans and even for extraterrestrial life in the galaxy. And I saw it from beginning to end, really for the first time, I would say within the last 10 years. I'd always heard about the movie, and I'd seen pieces of it, but this is a film that I feel like you have to sit down and watch it and give it your entire attention from beginning to end. And I know that I don't really understand it entirely, but I keep watching it over and over to see if I can get more insight. Now, it's definitely futurist, but it's definitely not Afrofuturist. So this is a highly influential film that, you know, it really transports the viewer to another realm. It doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue, particularly at the start of the film. And you really have to open your mind to this idea of what this monolith that has been present in all of these stages of terrestrial life, extraterrestrial life, what it really means and stands for. Do you have some thoughts about the film?
Yeah, you know, one thing that's pretty cool about it, it did inspire the aesthetic for an Afrofuturist themed music video, and that would be Scream with Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson. Mm-hmm. You know, they pulled the aesthetic from that film. Yeah, you know, I remember seeing that film as a kid and not knowing, but, you know, having a lot of questions about what was actually happening. And then later and looking at it, and you know, and this is the fun part. I mean, there's so much of the visuals have inspired, like I mentioned, you know, other music videos and other ideas. And I think it also kind of codified this idea of the lonely person navigating worlds in space. You know, I think about some of the space TV shows that came out before, and sometimes you had families. What was that? The robot TV show, and there was a robot.
Lost in Space.
And you had other narratives where it was, there's kind of this happy feel about space. And then I think about that film, and it sort of transformed that narrative a little bit with a sense of isolationism and really exploring space as this, you know, a space of wonder, of discovery, a person trying to find themselves. But yes, the imagery in that, I think for a lot of science fiction, art and images, I think they reference that film visually a lot.
A lot. And just the dimensions of the picture, and even how music is used in the film, because to have a science fiction film and we're thinking about the future, centuries in the future, and then that opening scene has classical music written centuries before, but how seamlessly that Strauss waltz goes with the majesty of being out in space and the grandeur of that. And it was a new way to use classical music. And I think that was really impressive and influential as well.
Yes, it's certainly a classic. Yeah, and that's the cool thing about a lot of our science fiction films. They're always challenging us.
Right. And trying to reimagine, because as you said, even like Star Trek, which was an early TV show that was highly influential in terms of imagining space travel and imagining people from different backgrounds working in one workspace and going to these other worlds where you meet people from other planets. But the set itself was kind of very fantastical. Like it was very, you know, like it was this fantasy version of what the future would be. And as we get into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and we see sci-fi films, those scenes with people on spacecraft start to become very lived-in looking, very not steampunk, but cyberpunk, I guess, and looking very lived-in. So by the time we get to like Alien and Blade Runner and some of those other films that I wanted to talk about, the high tech is looking, it's high, but it's old. It's new, but it's accepted. It's not new anymore, mm-hmm. you know? So
right.
What's your next choice of film?
Okay, well, next fun film for me is a film that called Neptune Frost by Saul Williams and Anicia Uzuman.
I'm not alone. Tell him I need somebody.
This film is pretty spectacular. Saul Williams, who many of you may know, is an esteemed poet. He's released poetry, music albums, you know, just a all-around genius. And, you know, Anicia directed this particular film. The two of them are a couple. And the film, it's probably one of the more fantastic Afrofuturist projects that you're going to see. It starts off in a coal mine in East Africa, and it becomes a sort of commentary on these miners who are really mining for the elements that fuel our technology today, our cell phones, our computers. And it moves from this space of someone who dies in this mine and sort of sends us into this trajectory where you have these rebels coming from these rebellious, unique personalities in this particular village community coming together. And they create like a hacker universe. It's like a doppelganger universe. So whether you want to say they're in the realm of the ancestors or they're in some sort of liminal space, it's people discovering themselves, leaving spaces where they have a sense of fear or possibly lost their lives, and then somehow jettisoning into this like rebellious hacker world. And on top of it, it's a musical.
I love that.
It's like, it's so fantastic. Not linear in one sense, but really communal in another. And I have to, you know, really give credit to the filmmakers for this one, because the project, I think it was initially envisioned as a graphic novel, and the graphic novel things didn't quite work out. And so they were able to do it as a film. And the film was in the Cannes Film Festival and the Toronto International Film Festival, and this award-winning film released in select theaters. And it's a marvel, in my opinion, being a person who works in film, that a film of this nature, of this scale, exists.
Wow. And you would think that it would be easier to create a graphic novel than like, oh, let's make a film, you know, out of this project. But thank goodness they did make a film, apparently, because it achieves what they wanted it to achieve. And there's music to boot. So it sounds like something I really need to see.
The music is amazing. It's like a futuristic African music written, you know, by Saul, all electronic. It's a fantastic spectacle of amazingness. And at the root of it is this idea of liberation, creating alternate spaces, this alternate hacker world that is then trying to help, I guess, the human world. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of film you can watch 1,000 times and get something new out of it. Very much like 2001 Space Odyssey. And I guess space is the place, right?
Space is the place. And I know that, you know, this idea of Afrofuturism is also giving people of color a sense of their own liberation, of being free to do what they want, free of the constraints of society as it's been set up, free from the past, free from even the constraints of living on Earth, you know, free to do and be who they are.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the terms of film, a freedom to push back, push past conventional filmmaking techniques or narrative styles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, many of your listeners, you know, you and I included, grew up watching a lot of projects where it was very much about the one character, their journey. Did they achieve the goal? Did they not? Right? There is a kind of formula to that storytelling. And some of the Afrofuturist films that we've mentioned are films that say, hey, there's other ways to tell a story.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm just going to mention another film on my sci-fi list because I'm learning something. I hope that the listeners are learning something key because I certainly am in talking to you, Tasha. But I'm going to mention a sci-fi film, again, one that everyone knows. It is Alien from 1979, directed by Ridley Scott. Now, Ridley Scott happens to be one of my favorite directors. He really knows how to create like this, it was very key in the 80s, like this sort of atmospheric look and feel to his films. And this film was also preserved in the U.S. National Film Registry. And its tagline was, in space, no one can hear you scream. And that really resonated with a lot of people. I mean, that was really striking.
Terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying. Okay. So aside from the storyline of a terrifying alien threat, what is notable to me about the film is what I mentioned earlier, is how its tone and approach, it just completely normalizes the idea of space travel. Yes, the film is set in the future. And at this point, you know, space travel, going to other worlds, other planets, coming back to Earth, going back and forth is completely normalized. This is how life is. And the voyage of this particular vehicle, the Nostromo, it may as well be any team of government workers taking their truck out for a routine day of inspections or pickups or whatever it is. And again, the visual approach makes this look like an extremely lived-in world as opposed to like the shiny high-tech look of other space films up to this point. And the futuristic tech is well worn. You know, you've got like these work relationships and the joking and the camaraderie of the people who work on the space vehicle. You know, they've got the rivalries, people want to be promoted, people want to get paid, you know, they're constantly joking around. They just happen to be in space, and women and people of color are a normal part of the team. Androids are also part of this society. So we've got science fiction combined with horror because we've got this alien monster picking off everyone on the ship one by one, killing them. So the film is highly influential by launching a plethora of sequels, and it's a benchmark in a new era of science fiction. And at the point that I first saw it, I was actually an editor at Essence Magazine, and I had been sent to Chicago for a conference. It was a what did they call it?
The Consumer Electronics Show.
And one of the things that they were selling was like a new giant television set in 1984, like something that would be like your whole living room wall. And to demonstrate it, they were showing this movie. And I just found myself standing in the conference center with a whole bunch of other people. And we're all like riveted watching this movie. And I stood there for like 45 minutes watching the whole movie. And the salesman came up to me. He said, I've seen the movie 50 times now. He said, your face as you watch this movie was just a whole movie unto itself. So, but again, Sigourney Weaver, more power to you, girl. Like, you saved the day.
And I think it was so major too, because, you know, she was a woman heroine.
Yeah.
In this tale, right? So she's got the big gun. I don't want to say she was the first, but certainly the first, among the first who comes to mind when I think about a woman, sci-fi heroine, you know, kick butt, bad A kind of lady who's really taking charge in a science fiction film. You know, she had the kind of roles that men typically had at the time, but it was her. And I think that struck me probably more than anything else, other than the guy eating the food and the alien coming out of the stomach and the,
Yes. And then when they found out the other guy was an android and you're not expecting that he's actually a robot, and they cut off his head and they just kept his head to talk to
him.
And then the monster itself, the alien itself, which was terrifying to look at. And the fact that, you know, he had a head and a mouth, and then another head and a mouth could come out of that, is just absolutely terrifying. I mean, there was Barbarella, but Jane Fonda had absolutely no, I mean, she was a sex kitten in space. And that was a whole decade before this.
Well, the next film might be a surprise to some of you, because I'm sure you haven't quite thought of it in the science fiction context, but I'm going to say The Wiz. Come on. I'm putting that film up as one of my top Afrofuturist films.
I was surprised to see it on the list. But once it was on the list, I said, I can sort of see this.
Well, I think about, you know, in the original Wizard of Oz, and also the Broadway production of The Wiz, you know, Dorothy was a young girl living in Kansas and sort of shot off into this new world, right? The tornado takes her away into this new land. But one of the things I think that made The Wiz really interesting was, of course, Dorothy was played by Diana Ross. She's portraying a young woman, kindergarten teacher, who's kind of shy and in her shell. And it's a snowstorm that sends her off. She's living in Harlem. And what's so amazing about the land of Oz in the film depiction of The Wiz is that Oz is really like an alternative world Manhattan.
Yep.
You had the taxis. You had the parks with the graffiti. You know, you had the public library, the grand disco scene that they have when Dorothy and friends arrive in Oz takes place in what was the outside of the Twin Towers.
Right.
And
the subway scenes.
Right. The subway scene. And so it was really taking a land that a city that was familiar for many of us. And I think for kids who grew up in the city in general, you know, it struck a chord, because it's like making urban landscapes or Black urban landscapes fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have the person in the subway who's selling the trinkets and those columns breaking off of the subway, chasing the Dorothy and friends. I mean, how terrifying was that, right?
I knew that subway station, and I could never look at those columns the same way again. So, I was like, stay away from the columns.
Or the cowardly lion busting out of the actual lions outside of the public library. I live in Chicago. The Art Institute has two lions outside of the building. As kids are always playing with it. And it does seem like there could be an animal in there. You know, I mean, just, you know, taking the city landscape and then making it fantastic and bombastically weird or exciting or frightening. I just thought was a really interesting take. You know, she's walking through junkyards, you know, she's going through, you know, befriending strangers. And so one thing we talk about in Afrofuturism a lot is this idea of reimagining yourself. And there's an arc of transformation and reimagining yourself around who you want to be. Or, and when you do that, you're claiming an essence of an aspect of who you already are. And that's a theme that really rings true in The Wiz, you know, as it does in The Wizard of Oz. Everything Dorothy needed, she already had. And her friends, you know, the Cowardly Lion and the Scarecrow who wants the brains and the Tin Man who wants a heart. These are all things that the Dorothy character wants for herself, you know, things that she has to reconnect with. So not to mention those, you know, the silver slippers. I think there's a fantasticness there. And of course, the film, you know, it starred Michael Jackson and you have Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor is the Wiz. And in one of the major Afrofuturist retrospective art shows that the Studio Museum of Harlem put together called The Shadow Took Shape, one of the major art pieces was the toppled Wiz head that was based off of Richard Pryor, right?
Can you help us, sir?
What's in it for me?
We'd be very grateful.
Right. So maybe it was 10 feet or so. But this giant Wiz head that was toppled. And so I think for me as a kid growing up, you know, in addition to Parliament Funkadelic album covers, my other sort of fantastic Black world was, you know, The Wiz, which I felt like I saw a million times as a little kid, still annual viewing at the family gatherings. So,
wow.
So that film I'm going to put in the Afrofuturist canon.
I love that. To be honest with you, I saw it when it came out. I hated it for some reason. And I think part of it was because I knew New York and I could see New York through the sets. I had seen The Wizard of Oz 5 million times and I just couldn't wrap my head around it. Now I love it. Now I love the Black lens through which the story is told. And so I can see the Afrofuturist underpinnings in it as you explain it. So that's a wonderful thing. And sometimes your perspective on these things does change. You can see something and love it and then see it later and think, oh my God, this is trash. What did I see in this? Or you can see it again and appreciate it for what it is. And that might even apply to the next movie on my list, which is The Terminator that came out in 84, directed by James Cameron.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. I want to wait. There's a bench over there.
I'll be back.
I distinctly remembered going to see this film after work with some of my Essence colleagues. So this is from the same era. And, you know, I was just going to go. I wasn't a big fan of futuristic suspense or Arnold Schwarzenegger or anything like that. But I just found myself totally engaged and riveted by this idea of a dystopian future and how a time traveler could potentially alter that future by going back in time to where things went wrong, which I thought was a brilliant idea. And I'm sure it had been used before, but this was the first time I'd seen that idea of going back in time to change the future. And also the idea that the things that humans invent would eventually decimate or threaten human existence in the future, which is a theme that comes in several movies where the robots revolt or the cyborgs want to take over or whatever it is and get rid of humankind. So the film is combining all these different themes in science fiction. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was perfect because he's already an alien. Like, who else looks like him? Who else in America sounded like this giant Austrian bodybuilder? So he was like the perfect guy, but nobody else in the film was really a big star. And I think that added to the grittiness of it. It was kind of dark, but it was also, it had love interest, it had romance, it had suspense, and it just made us think, or it made me think about where technology could possibly be going. And also that, you know, there will always be war. There's war in the past, there's war now, and in the future, we'll be fighting these horrible wars with even more destructive weapons.
It's funny, you mentioned Terminator, and, you know, at that time, we're starting to sort of shift from the idea of, oh, the aliens are coming to get us, to our technologies are they're going to get us, right? These robots we create, these cyborgs, these, you know, all these, our technologies are going to become problematic. And that theme that was sort of ushered in, it was called cyberpunk. It's also something that we see in the Matrix film, where it's, you know, sort of this grim chic, right? You have the swank leather, and you have the cyborg metallic eyepiece. You know, you have
the sunglasses, always, and yeah,
the finely edged sunglasses. Everybody's wearing something very sleek and form fitting, and pleather and leather and all of that. So it's like a world of black metallic shimmers and gray. Yep. No bright colors in these worlds. And that too, you know, in another sort of sense, it was sort of reflecting concerns about the technologies in our society and how they could go awry, or, you know, so this idea of the robots taking over or the systems descending upon us, in some ways, I don't want to say it entirely replaced the alien trope, but it became like the new bad guy was that which we were creating.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've read from the older generation of sci-fi movies, when you had these aliens and monsters threatening people, it was sort of a transfer of the idea of the Cold War enemy, Russia or China, their existential threat to our existence, whether there was going to be nuclear war, and filmmakers were transferring that idea to film with these monsters or aliens coming to threaten humankind. But as technology and science developed new ideas and new forms and new theories, now we, as you say, shift to not only how technology can help us, but where it can possibly go wrong, which was a part of the story of my next film choice, which was AI, Artificial Intelligence, directed by Steven Spielberg, about mechanized beings.
The new, I'll say, theme under a lot of science fiction films now is, if you don't do this one thing, the world will explode. The universe will implode. Right. So there's always this high state of urgency. And, you know, the enemy oftentimes being technologies we created, and sometimes aliens. But one other thing, you know, that sort of cyborg aesthetic, it also reflected sort of this, I don't want to call it a hopelessness, but it's sort of another take on like urban decay.
Yes.
And a sense of, hey, these futures that we're working towards, they don't look so bright. Which is another twist, right? So at first, you think about 50s, 60s sci-fi, you know, the future is this glorious space to move into.
Meet George Jetson!
And then you have sort of this new era where there's a different thought about that, and in interrogating these issues more.
Right.
Which is pretty interesting. So the other film I want to mention is Enemy of the State, which does star Will Smith.
A powerful man has been murdered.
Holy.
A hidden camera recorded the crime. An innocent bystander was given the evidence.
We have reason to believe that Mr. Zavitz may have passed sensitive materials to you.
No, he didn't pass me anything.
How did you happen to be at Ruby's today?
I was shopping for some lingerie. That's still legal, isn't it?
For your wife?
No, I was picking something up for myself. I do a little cross-dressing on the weekends.
Well, what I thought was interesting about Enemy of the State was they did have this sort of use of technology where there was a level of surveillance. Mm-hmm. That level of surveillance, I think in the film, was probably the first time, one of the first times we sort of saw that in a film, where people are being tracked in so many different ways. And so it is a political film, but it's also one where I think some of the audience become a little more aware of their gadgets as tracking devices. Will Smith has probably been in more science fiction films than a lot of Black actors. Something that I mentioned in my Afrofuturism book, whether it's the film that he did with his son or, you know, any of the other projects. I mean, Men in Black, Independence Day.
I Am Legend, I, Robot.
Yes. And I Am Legend was one of my favorites, too, because here you're following a guy who thinks he's the only person in the world, and he's in a world taken over by zombies. He's trying to make whatever, you know, antidote he can to try to transform the zombies back into humans. And we're pretty much following him along, thinking of him as a relatively normal guy in an extraordinary circumstance. And then in the middle of the film, he meets a woman and a kid, and then suddenly through their interactions you realize, wait a second, this guy, he's not handling this scenario as well as he appeared to be when he was by himself. And this other lady introduces the idea that there is a human world to go to, right? So now we have the new utopia to move through. And I keep thinking about, you know, Sun Ra and this altered destiny, or this Wiz and this alternate world. So now we have Will Smith in this space where there's supposed to be a utopic world where humans exist, and this beyond the land of zombies. And he is in such a space where he doesn't even think that's possible. It's hard for him to even reconcile with the fact that there's another human being who's alive, who's with them.
Have you seen The Omega Man, which is what that film is based on?
I have not seen Omega Man.
Same basic story.
The last man on Earth is not alone.
Where Charlton Heston is the only man. He's loving Los Angeles and driving around and going to the movies and during the day and in his, you know, convertible and enjoying life, until night falls when he has to lock himself in his apartment because the zombies are coming out. But what I will say about the movie, the woman and another guy that he ends up meeting who are human and not zombies are all Black. And he ends up having a love affair with the Black woman protagonist, which was something that hadn't really been seen as often, and certainly not with Charlton Heston back in the 60s when that film came out. Or maybe it was early 70s. So I find that really interesting that when the film is remade, it's with Will Smith in the starring role.
That is really fascinating. And thematically, you know, zombies aside, it reminds me of a short story that W.E.B. Du Bois wrote called The Comet, where a comet hits the New York, and he, you know, is really upset because he feels like he's the only person who survived. And then suddenly he realizes, wait, now I can go into the all-white restaurants, and I can go into the stores that I was barred from going to as a Black man. And, you know, this end of the world seems pretty okay until he meets a woman and, you know, realizes he's not alone. And, you know, this story takes another direction.
That sounds like a Harry Belafonte movie that came out. It was the same thing. These people wake up in New York and there's nobody there except Harry Belafonte. And he's just roaming the city by himself, getting along. And then he realized he's not alone. There is a white woman there.
This is New York, as no man has ever seen it. Empty. Deserted. Its teeming millions gone. This is the setting for the most unusual picture ever filmed.
I know you're there! I know you're staring at me!
The last three people alone in the world.
So they start to form a friendship and survive, but then a white man shows up, he survives, and then the two men is like they're going to battle to the death over who gets to be with this white woman. And I wish I could think of the name of this movie. I'm going to find it out.
What's funny, this short story that W.B. Du Bois wrote, it was in a collection. And, you know, some people who might have been familiar with the story maybe some decades ago didn't quite think of it as Afrofuturist or science fiction because it was a short story in the midst of a bunch of essays that he was writing about his life. And it wasn't until Sheree Renee Thomas put it in her Dark Matter anthology of Black speculative fiction and science fiction in the early 2000s, that short story was viewed in that context. So here you have this sort of legendary Black writer advocate. I don't know. I mean, W.B. Du Bois was so many things. You know, he really shaped discourse for how to talk about Black life and advocated for so many of her rights, but he also wrote science fiction. Because that story came out in the 19-teens, who knows? Maybe it inspired all these films that we're talking about now.
There you go. The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. That is the name of the movie from 1959.
Fascinating.
So it's Harry Belafonte, Inger Stevens, and Mel Ferrer. So I wonder if it's a situation where the idea was borrowed without attribution. It's possible.
You know what? It's a lot of similarities.
Sounds like.
You know, one film I want to mention is, you know, for our Matrix fans, you know, we've analyzed the Matrix probably ad nauseum at some point, right? I'm a big, big Matrix fan. But the creators of the Matrix also created a film called Cloud Atlas.
Fear. Belief. Love. Phenomena that determine the course of our lives. These forces begin long before we are born and continue after we perish.
Cloud Atlas is a film that I thought was really fascinating because it's hopping all these times and worlds, and it's dealing with characters who are essentially reincarnated in these different periods. You're going back to ancient times all the way to futuristic times. It stars Tom Hanks and Halle Berry, amongst others. And there's always sort of this tug and pull between what's morally correct. Through, I don't want to just say good and bad, but certainly what's just rather than those who are taking advantage of opportunities, opportunistic people versus those who are trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you look from, you know, periods from the transatlantic slave trade all the way up to, you know, some sort of futuristic interstellar world. I guess it was on Earth. I'm not sure. And you have the same characters over and over again. One season they might be Black, and then the next lifetime they're white. One period they might be on the right side of history, and then the next lifetime they're on the wrong side of history, you know, or vice versa. And I thought it was a very difficult tale to tell. Because originally it's a book. And in a book, sure, if characters are reincarnated in various lifetimes, you don't have to deal with this makeup issue, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing with actual human beings and you're replicating the storyline, especially if they're changing the context of ethnicity, right?
Which right.
Maybe some characters are able to do a little easier than others, or their looks are changing dramatically. You know, it was a real interesting feat. I know that there were some audiences who were not fans of the story. I think they were looking for something that was specifically about the Matrix. But I think thematically, if you look at the Matrix and you look at Cloud Atlas, it has this sort of liberatory undertone about liberating oneself from systems and people who are taking steps to do so. And what they do in one period, helping those in the next generation or in another period kind of move along to achieve an end, one that values humanity and all spaces. So I think Cloud Atlas is a pretty fascinating film to watch.
Well, I would say it's fascinating. It can also be termed confounding. That would be another way.
Yes.
That'd be another way to put it. But I do think that it is an enormous achievement in filmmaking, and I probably need to spend more time with it. But it is, the storytelling is very interesting. And I think probably reading the book would illuminate more, but you know, a lot of people are not about reading the source material. So, and films do need to stand on their own many times. So,
right. And it might be tough for people to think about reincarnation if they're not people who think about reincarnation, right? Particularly the idea that, yes, you could be a man in this life and perhaps a woman in the next. You could be Black in one life and white in the next, right? Depending on, who knows, any number of random set of factors. And so, yeah, so achieving that with makeup was not an easy task.
Exactly. One of my favorite films was Blade Runner. We could have a whole show about Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's probably a quintessential cyberpunk film.
Absolutely. But Itasha, tell us again the title of your new book and where people can get it.
The book is called Black Panther, a Cultural Exploration, all about the history and the cultural elements that shaped the Black Panther comic and in turn shaped us. And you can pick that up at your favorite bookstore. If they don't have it, you can order it. But you can also get it online at IndieBound or Amazon or whatever your favorite online site is.
Fantastic. I thank you so much for your time and sharing your wisdom with me today.
Oh, thank you. This has been a joy.
Was that enlightening or what? I am so grateful to Itasha Womack for stopping by and to you for listening. Till next time, for the Words on Flicks show, I'll see you soon. Keep watching and keep watching out.